intention of leaving, an alternative to illegal migration on the world.
This afternoon at 3 here on 91.3 WLRN. Support for NPR Newscast comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday pajamas for the whole family, including dogs and cats, at pajamagram.com.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, I'm sure you're going to get your cat some pajamas for the holidays. We just heard about that. Well, what happens when a neuroscientist finds he has brain patterns that mimic Ted Bundy or Columbine High School perpetrator Eric Harris? The result is enlightenment and a book titled The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain. University of California, Irvine, Professor James Fallon now joins us from public station KCUI in Irvine, California. Welcome to you, James Fallon.
Joseph, Bonnie, thanks for having me here.
Hey, great to have you. Good afternoon. So it's true, many of us conjure up a Ted Bundy or a John Wayne Gacy when we think of a psychopath, but of course, not all psychopaths are serial killers. So could you just tell us what the common characteristics of psychopaths are and kind of distinguish it from sociopaths, if you would?
Well, Bonnie, there's a lot of disagreement on whether these things exist because they overlap with other personality disorders like malignant narcissism and antisocial personality disorder. So there's a question of really if they exist. The other thing, the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath, even though people will tell you what it is, there really is very little agreement on this and what the causes, that is especially what the biological causes are and how the environment and genes interact to produce one or the other or both. So it's really a very contentious sort of thing. But, you know, given that sort of technical proviso, you know, you can look at psychopathy and sociopathy, independent of their cause, as the behaviors that include things such as aggressive narcissism. And these are this one factor, and this is in the Robert Hare psychopathy checklist. That's people who are not only glib and have this superficial charm and this grandiose sense of self-worth and narcissism, but they're pathological liars and very manipulative, and they really don't feel much guilt at all. And they're very callous, and they lack a certain kind of empathy, not all kinds of empathy, just the interpersonal sort of emotional empathy.
What other kind of empathy is there other than that personal empathy?
Well, the one kind of empathy is the one that most of us value so much in people we love and in people that we interact with, which is a real connection that when you see somebody in pain or in need, that not only do you understand it, but you feel it yourself. It actually registers in your brain as something painful to you and very upsetting. The other kind is what's called cognitive empathy. And that is more related to what's called the mirror neuron system, where you understand, you look at people who, a person who might be suffering, and you understand it, you have sympathy for it, you may actually do something about it, but you don't feel it yourself. And you know, many psychopaths have that second kind. And, you know, a very odd thing, and now this is not psychopathy per se, but people like Gandhi or Mandela or Mother Teresa were not very good to be interpersonally involved with. They seemed to have very little interpersonal emotional empathy, but they had tremendous cognitive empathy because they loved the world. They loved all the children of the world. And these are very different things. So you do find psychopaths who have really a love for everybody but the people close to them.
James Fallon, you say that you don't take immediate offense at anger, but you will retaliate in time. Could you tell us more about that? I don't think I'd want to cross you.
Well, Joseph, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, when I not only found the biological markers from the brain imaging and also the genetics, you know, back six years ago, but since then, really had to start taking it seriously. And I am close to a number of psychiatrists and neurologists who know me and some of my behaviors really well. And when I went and asked them, I said, tell me what you think of me. I did the same thing with my wife and people, friends that go back. This is a question you may not want to ask people. I didn't get the answer I thought I'd get. But, you know, the one thing is we're going through all my traits with a couple of psychiatrists. And I mentioned one thing, and they asked me, so what do you feel about revenge and how do you get angry? I said, well, actually, people don't know when I'm furious at them. I will get really, really angry at them, and I'll never show it. I don't have a tell that way. And you can't read it, so people never know when I'm angry. And what I'll do...
Excuse me, a little technical difficulty.
Sorry about that.
That was my amygdala firing off. That's the kind of anger I get, but I don't show it. You know, it doesn't come through the speakers. And so, and then I told them that what I'll do is I may wait 1, 2, 3, 4 years and get even with them, and they'll never know what hit them because I won't. They don't know where it comes from, and I never get revenge anything more than I think is fair or just. That is to the extent that I was harmed, if you will, or somebody near me was harmed. And so, and when I said that, they go, that is psychopathic. And that, you would think it might not be, but that ability to show no emotion whatsoever, no stress to, and be furious and then get even years later, that's not a great trait.
Hmm. Could you give us an example of a time that happened and what you did and how you got even, if that's not too personal?
Well, this would blow my cover completely.
I assume your colleagues, your friends, your family all know from your book that you have these tendencies. So
right, and but for the specific example, I won't give you a specific example. I'll give you something about it because if somebody, let's say, I think they've screwed me in some sort of academic deal, you know, a grant, a publication or something like that, or has tried to harm, you know, our work, my work, then I will retaliate, but maybe years later. Likewise, if somebody does something personal to somebody, to me, and let's say they try to rat me out for something I did, you know, some naughty behavior I did. Well, they're going to hear about it at some point, but they won't know where it came from. And so it includes both personal behavior and my also professional behavior. I mean, one of the things I have is like a tremendous ego. I'm really narcissistic. And I do have this sense of self-worth, and I'm probably pretty protective of that, you know? And so the way I react effectively is, you know, the way you're supposed to act. Somebody gets you mad, you say to them, look, that really ticks me off. Don't do that. You know, you confront them and do that. I won't do that. Mm-hmm. And to me, I don't give people the pleasure of getting me twice that way.
Now, I read that you're a distant descendant of the infamous Lizzie Borden. Of course, she was unconvicted but considered an axe murderer.
Yeah, well, she and I, cousin Lizzie and I, we have a common ancestor line.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, and that ancestor line is the Cornells. And this is something my mother brought up to me in a book that had just come out. This was at a party about the same time that we found out about my brain scan and the whole family. She says, you got to read this book. It's about your father's side of the family. Now, her family were Sicilians. And, you know, her father, my grandfather, came when he was 11 to the United States and lived on the streets. You know, he was very poor and everything, but a resourceful guy. But she always got teased about being mafia because all of the people in the family, of their family, married civilians, which are non-Sicilians. And so she found this book called Killed Strangely, and it was about the Cornell line. And in there, it details the first murder of a mother by a son, matricide, in the colonies. And this was in the late 1660s. And it's about that trial, but she also noted, look at the other people in that same line that led from Thomas Cornell to us. And there are other murderers. And since that time, and even up, or just recently in the past few months, found a total of 4 lines of murderers and people who are really very nasty on that side of the family.
So have we determined that psychopathic tendencies are genetically transferred?
Well, the traits are, you know, when we talk about a psychopath, that's a categorical psychopath. That's somebody, for example, who scores 28 points or more on the 40-point Robert Hare scale. For those, we know that the traits are associated with genetics. That is, certain forms of genes, certain alleles of genes, that have to do with the regulation of emotional responses, aggressiveness, violence, but also the types of empathy and reaction to stress, and also a sense of who you are. And they map quite well on these traits. But there's no particular pattern that says, oh, if you have these, you will definitely be a psychopath. But you certainly will have the traits.
How about early years in animal cruelty, the kind of people that pick the wings off of flies and that? How does that fit in?
Well, has been a fairly stable sort of feature for, you know, young psychopaths in
and
training,
bedwetting?
As it were. Well, the bedwetting
and
turns
arson.
Out not to... Yeah, well, the bedwetting is not too good a predictor, as it turns out. This is the so-called McDonald triangle. But the cruelty to animals, and this is not just one or two times when some kid kicks a dog. You know, this is like repeated stuff. And also sexual behavior, that is abuse of other kids. Sexual abuse of other kids is a very bad sign. But if it happens, you know, multiple times, not just one time. So, these are tells for early development of psychopathy. But there are other things that a trained person, like a psychiatrist or psychologist, who can see a developing psychopath in a two-year-old. It's quite an alarming thing.
You can see it developing in a two-year-old?
Yeah, I mean, in some of the kids, there are psychiatrists. Now, I've known... You know, the people I work with who said this since the late 70s, and they refused to ever admit this because they, first of all, they didn't want to be attacked publicly, and what do you do about it? So they have kept it, it's been kind of a secret in psychiatry for people who study this. And now it's slowly, people are starting to say that they can do this. Not every psychopath, but people, the idea of this primary psychopath who seems to have all the genetics and the brain pattern of psychopathy. And that's usually what people think of as psychopath, whereas the sociopath is somebody who gets these traits because of very harsh environmental conditions. They're mad as hell, and they have been harmed early and abandoned early, but they may not have the genetics for this.
I see. And then, well, you talk about the childhood abuse, but we have to take a break. We'll come back and discuss that. We're speaking with James Fallon. He's an award-winning neuroscientist, and at the University of California, Irvine. And he's written a memoir, The Psychopath Inside, on today's Topical Currents. Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back.
It's 91.3 WLRN. You can learn or improve your Spanish in just 7 days at the University of Miami's Intensive Language Institute. This interactive instructional format allows you to get maximum results in a minimum amount of time. Classes start January 4th. Details at continue.miami.edu/7-day. Handel's Messiah is a centuries-old holiday tradition that culminates in the singular Hallelujah Chorus. Grammy-nominated Seraphic Fire returns in this South Florida tradition to present Handel's ultimate musical masterpiece. This concert has sold out 5 years in a row. Performances December 20th to 22nd in Dade, Broward, and Boca Raton. Tickets at seraphicfire.org or 305-285-9060.
Through its contemporary arts project, Vizcaya Museum and Gardens presents the Academic and the Avant-Garde exhibit. This year marks the centennial of the 1913 Armory Show, the exhibition that introduced America to modern art by European and American artists. Details at Vizcaya.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor James Fallon. He's the author of The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. James Fallon, tell us about the importance of the amygdala and basic behavior. Is that sort of like the reptile brain?
Well, Joseph, that has been called part of the reptile brain in all vertebrates, all animals really, have that. And it, what it does is it regulates all our basic sort of id types of behaviors, you know, from eating and drinking, with sexual activity, predatory behavior,
all the aggression, good stuff.
All the great stuff. And it's, this has this very close relationship with part of the frontal lobe called the orbital cortex, which is more associated with ethics and morality and control of impulsivity. These two are usually in balance. They inhibit each other. And so that you only do certain things. You only kill. You only have sex under what would be socially acceptable conditions, right? When those two are not talking to each other, you know, bad things happen. Now, one kind of murder is called the impulsive murder, and they just, what they have is a loss of activity in that orbital cortex, so they can't control impulsivity. They're hothead killers, or, you know, real, these hotheads we know. That's not what a psychopath is. A psychopath has not only, you know, a lack of an understanding, really, of morality and ethics, but also the amygdala, if you look at the brain scans, has hot and cold spots. It's abnormal. So some things are turned on too much and off too much, so that they, it looks a bit like an addict's, you know, a drug addict's amygdala in some respects. And that way it can't be satisfied too well. So in the cases for psychopaths who are really aggressive about it and do, you know, pretty awful things and who don't inhibit it, they and addicts, the problem is that they can never be satisfied. So even when something happens, the urge keeps building up. And it may take, you know, for a cigarette addict overnight or for an opiate addict a week. But maybe for some psychopaths who kill or rape, it could be a 6 months, a year, two, 3 years between times that this urge to build is built up.
So your case is interesting. I'm wondering for our audience, because we've alluded to it, that you, now what did you score on the hair scale?
I've taken that in several times, including online, and I score around a 20. So the threshold for a categorical psychopath is 28. I have some behaviors on the factor two, which is really the, it has to do with criminality and antisocial personality disorder. That's different than the narcissism side. On that side, I don't have criminal traits. I don't have criminal behaviors. And, you know, one place that I get off easy is in understanding the context of this, because some behaviors that are appropriate to defend oneself, let's say in a violent inner city neighborhood, are not appropriate because they're not to protect yourself. They wouldn't be, you know, in a very safe neighborhood in the suburbs, let's say. But also the era that you grew up in, you know, and when I was growing up, I was making pipe bonds, blowing them up. We were stealing cars, doing all these things. But at that time, it was just like, oh, the boys are having a good time. He loves chemical engineering. You know, and we used to get away with this because it wasn't considered as it is now. So I don't get extra points because at the time I was doing those things, they wouldn't be considered psychopathic. They would just be obnoxious.
I wonder if you weren't so highly educated, say if you were a high school dropout and you were growing up in a bad area of town, would you have been more violent or criminally oriented?
Yeah, well, Joseph, you know, you know, growing up, you know, when I really looked at all this stuff, finally when it was all in front of me in the past couple of years, because you don't see things. Somebody says something to you, they give you a hint, and then 4 years later they say something. If you look at your whole life and put it together, things, you know, you can start to realize something that's not exactly a pretty picture. And so people would say that it was a very good thing that of where I grew up, because I would have been a gang leader, I would have been in the mafia, I would have been a very dangerous person. And I used to just laugh that off. And you know, as a scientist, I was, among my friends and colleagues, a poster boy for genes controlling everything. And I really thought that environment had very little to do with who you are and your ultimate behavior. And this this experience the past couple of years has made me eat crow. And I've had to change my tune. You know, I have enough, I guess, egotism and pride as a scientist that, I've got to say that I was wrong about this. And, you know, in looking back what happened in my own life and in comparing it to other people, I realized what a kind of a childhood I grew up in. And it was for two specific reasons. I was treated so wonderfully. I had an idyllic, upbringing from the time I was born all the way through. And even though I went through some dark periods in my behavior that my mother just told me about a year ago, I was a very happy kid. And I had the advantage of, at the time, I was good looking, very athletic. I was a five sports varsity guy and did that in college. And I was very personable. And I used all that, kind of charm and the glibness and all that to great advantage. And if you have all those things and you come from an upper middle class family, and I'm sort of smart enough so that when people around me were getting in trouble, the police were letting me free because I would make them laugh and they said, this is a good guy and he's screwing around. But I got away with a lot. And now I realize what that upbringing and what that nurturing did and how it changed probably who I became.
Looking at your photo on the book jacket, you look like kind of a rough guy. Is that accurate?
Well,
that's just my personal take.
But. Yeah, right. Well, my wife said, she was doing an interview at the BBC, and I said, just be honest now. I guess we might got to be honest about this. And they asked her about me, and they said, well, I'm married to two guys, and I've always known these two guys, and one is this great, fun, interesting, wonderful guy, sociable guy, and there's this other dark character I don't like. And that, and after it, I said, what? I said, you're serious? And she goes, absolutely. And other people who've been very close to me, during my life said the same thing. And even my son said, I get a look on me, kind of a predatory look sometime, and I just don't act it out. You know what I mean? I'm not violent, and I think it's because I don't have to be. I get, I always got everything I wanted. I got all the, all the material things I wanted, education, sex, everything, and power that I would ever want just because of how I was navigating my way through my social life and professional life. And I just think I had it very easy that way. And, I like myself, but I got to fess up here that I think that I was given so many things through the environment that I guess I'm what you'd call a lucky psychopath more than anything.
You call yourself a born killer. Does it concern you that you have this genetic makeup? Do you worry you could, snap or slide into a psychopathic behavior or kill somebody ever? I mean, well, does it worry you or your family?
Well, Bonnie, I have strange thoughts sometimes and dreams, and I don't act them out. And when I've talked with people about these, they don't have the same sort of dream and ideations, thoughts about it. And I just am able to settle it down. And, if you ask yourself why, why am I able to inhibit that, these natural, violent tendencies, is, frankly, I don't want to get caught. And I'm having too good a time in my life. And so I think it's out of a certain level of hedonism with my life that I wouldn't do it. And I haven't done it. I'm really... not somebody who does that, but when I got became about 19 or 20 in college, I became much more aggressive. I was more of a pussycat early on, and I was very religious growing up, and had an obsessive compulsive disorder and was very intense about that. I was the Catholic boy of the year in my diocese in the capital of New York, and that so I was a little bit strange, but I had so many other positive things. I would quickly get into all those activities, and they would just sort of melt that stuff away.
Why have you decided to share all this? I mean, it's kind of a big admission.
Yeah, well, what happened is we had started an adult stem cell biotech company, the CEO and I, and he said, hey, why don't we go to the TED and give a TED talk? And I go, hey, what do you mean a TED talk? He says, no, just give it. Come up with something. So I said, and this was before they were, they had videos of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so I went and I gave the talk, and it was about a piece of this, a small piece of this. And it was really well received, like very quickly. And I got calls from the Wall Street Journal. And I got calls from Simon Mirren of Criminal Minds. Said, you got to come up and act. I've just written. I know what you're talking about. And then in about... when that came out, I was very surprised because my colleague said, you got about 30,000 hits overnight on this TED talk. At that point, I was outed. It was not my intention to do that, because I had spent my life really not talking about this at all, and not wanting to share that. And but there it was. And then the question is, as this snowball, what do you do with it? And so I took the opportunity, because of the truth in front of me, you know, and that was obvious, to really, and ask my family, do you want me to be talking about this and everything? And they've been very good about it. My wife has been great about this, and even my mother, who's 96 now, she is a little shocked, and she read the book. She's, I thought you were a good boy. You know, she's doing this. And so, I mean, some people have been disturbed, especially two close friends of mine. But anyway, I thought it gave me the opportunity to talk about this and talk about where psychiatry is going, but really about what makes us up and about what normality is and what pathology is. So it was partially a scientific academic exercise, but also what my psychiatrist friends in Norway said was a Lutheran confession. I still don't know what that means, but that's what they called it.
Something like that. Maybe there will be many benefits that can come from this. I mean, have you thought about that?
Well, I tried to start with simple things in the past year and how I treat people. Because, you know, in a way, I'm still the same person and I kind of don't care, but that's just the way I am. But I said I'll try to be considerate and do the right things with people, especially close to me. And I've started to do that, but I got to think of it. I have to think of doing it. But my wife and people close to me appreciate that I'm trying. They say, we know your heart's not into it, but the fact you're trying is important. But, you know, how I'm trying to use this, now, you know, how do you use this? In a positive way for society, because I'm a person who could have gone really wrong in society, and so I probably owe it to others to kind of help them along, if I can at all, mm-hmm. with the story. But one thing is, we're putting together a number of proposals in the European Union and with our own armed forces, etc., to really prove how environment really can destroy a culture and a neighborhood over, you know, multiple years of bullying and abuse, and how it can take people who are vulnerable, that they you know, maybe 20% of the population of the kids are vulnerable. The others are not really vulnerable to this. They're just not genetically set to have this really psychopathic response as they grow up. But if we can show this biologically, then I think it will help, you know, maybe nations and groups who are belligerent or otherwise, to show them, if they keep up with this, if they keep fomenting discord in the streets, and it happens everywhere, that they're going to destroy themselves. I don't have any illusion to tell anybody that, oh, war is bad and violence is bad, but to show somebody that they're going to kill their own people doing it, I think might be more effective. But you got to do that scientifically. So we've started some proposals to get funding for this in different parts of the world and locally.
We're speaking with James Fallon. He is an award-winning neuroscientist from University of California, Irvine. And it's Topical Currents, a short break. His book is The Psychopath Inside. We'll be right back.
It's 91.3 WLRN. We're funded by listeners like you and by Kaiser University. For more than 35 years, Kaiser has been committed to helping students succeed. Kaiser is now accepting applications for their master's degree as a family nurse practitioner. More information available at kugradschool.com. New Year's Eve Concert 2014, Salute to Vienna. Three opportunities to celebrate with the all-star cast of European singers, dancers, and full orchestra. This performance includes soaring melodies from operettas and the beautiful Blue Danube Waltz. Salute to Vienna, New Year's Eve at Coral Springs Center, New Year's Day at Kravis Center, and Saturday, January 4th at Adrian Arsch Center. Tickets available online at salutetovienna.com.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Bladder and Prostate Investigations, directed by Dr. Angelo Goose, seeking persons 18 or older who suffer from urinary leakage to investigate a medication. Details at 954-494-2833.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor James Fallon. He's a neuroscientist and professor at University of California, Irvine. We're talking about his book, The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain. If you have questions or comments for James Fallon or just a question about psychopathy or sociopathy, call us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org.
And we'll take a call. This is a listener, John, in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, this question is for Professor Fallon. I've been very interested in the relationship between personality and kind of brain activity. And I wanted to see if, does one affect the other, or does, you know, brain activity affect your personality or vice versa? And how does that affect, you know, does family constellation therapy work into that, as in, past traumas that haven't been resolved in your family keep getting passed down to generation to generation, and they're not resolved, and people will keep that behavior active.
Well, John, one of the aspects of transgenerational affected behavior, like transgenerational violence, is that there's very good evidence now that this kind of epigenetics, that is the how the genes that you do have are modified, not only by early experience, but that these marked genes in the epigenome can be passed on to, like, your grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's been shown, but it hasn't been shown for violence per se, and it's one of the things that we're studying now. We're starting to study, and so, I mean, it's a great question, but if it follows the principle of transgenerational effects, the idea is that if you are born into a violent neighborhood, into a violent family, that certain genes, like the serotonin transporter and some others, they can turn your brain two ways. If the early experience is violence, then that sets up the circuitry in the brain to expect violence growing up, and the way to respond to that is with more violence, right? And so it's a way of tuning the brain early. But on the other hand, if you're exposed to early love and bonding, and you're not abandoned and all that, then that same gene that was a risk gene becomes a very powerful positive effect on behavior. So there's this epigenetic, you know, interaction of genes and environment that is at work, and probably, but we don't know for sure, for violence and psychopathy transgenerationally. Now, in terms of the interaction or the causality between the genes and the behaviors, your first question, I mean, this is the great chicken and egg question. You know, what's causing what? And that's a very hard thing to do unless you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to study, and with all these control groups. These are very expensive studies, so, you know, finding funds to do that for any trait is probably about $3 million to do that. And you're working with the military to do it, for, you know, to really do a comprehensive analysis. So nobody knows, because nobody's really looked at it this way yet. And we do have the tools now, imaging genetics and this, you know, the psychometric tools to integrate them in a modeled statistical model behavior that we've used very successfully, and other people have, for schizophrenia, depression, etc. Now, I've never been completely sold on the idea of lasting plasticity. That is, of course, there's brain plasticity with learning and memory, etc. But whether you can keep having a behavior over and over again that will rewire the brain and it will last for many years, that is still not known.
You mentioned serotonin, and we know about that, of course, you know, the reuptake of serotonin and depression and all that, but you mention it in terms of this MAOA gene, or the warrior gene. Can you tell us about serotonin, the brains of psychopaths, and how that, what it's like, or what it, how it functions?
Well, for the MAOA, the monoamine oxidase gene, there are two forms of it. In one form of the enzyme doesn't break down serotonin too well. So serotonin lasts a long time floating around in the brain. Early on, during development in the uterus. The fetus who has that one form, their brain is bathed in serotonin, so much so that those areas that will ultimately respond to serotonin, that affect emotionality and aggression and violence, they kind of are turned off. So that when you're born, even when you do secrete serotonin, which normally would make you calm, right?
Mm-hmm.
People get mad and then they, you know, over a minute or a couple of minutes, they get calm. Well, if those areas of the brain have been genetically turned off in utero, then the release of that doesn't work. And so that doesn't mean they're psychopaths, but they will be hotheads and they will stay mad a long time. So they'll have the trait of aggressiveness, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're a categorical psychopath.
You say that you don't have close personal bonds with those who work close to you or a sense of romance for your wife. How does that fit into psychopathic patterns? And how does your wife feel about that?
Yeah, this doesn't go over that well in my house. But like she says, you think this is something new to me? You know, and my kids have actually, and my sister and some other people have told me this over the years, but I wasn't listening to them. And so once it was all there and they explained to me and I said, I see what you mean. I then had to look at all the motivations for what I do and really the emotional response that I'm having when I'm interacting with people, because I know how to act. But it's sort of just like a conditioned response. So I can look like I care a lot. But when I look at the ultimate behavior, which is really what counts, I can act very close to somebody. But if somebody walks by, I see a party somewhere else, I'll walk out the door and follow it. I mean, I'll do stuff like that. So my actual behaviors don't follow what I thought about my own sense of connectedness to people close to me and my sense of romance, because I'm so fickle that, I do those things. So the behavior is really what tells you what's going on.
So you have to sort of work, say, to provide champagne and candlelights on Valentine's Day.
Oh, I have to bring a list. I absolutely have. You know, so what's what may be very natural to some guys is really, I've got to think about it a lot.
I'm wondering, how can we know if somebody's a psychopath? I mean, what do we look for, short of, you know, obvious behaviors? But are they too good at hiding it or feigning emotion for us to know that they are psychopaths?
Well, a high-functioning, you know, pro-social psychopath or near psychopath, they're so good at reading people, and they can read your thoughts and emotions really well. See, they don't have their emotions to get in the way of their thinking,
mm-hmm.
cognitive thinking.
But they can learn to cry at a movie.
Absolutely. And so they can learn all these things because they can condition their own responses. And then if you put a lie detector on them, they don't show it. They don't even feel the anxiety to begin with. So there's no real emotional response to begin with. So they appear to be not guilty, right? And they have very few tells, the real smart ones. The ones that have other brain damage or are not too smart, they get caught in the getaway car, you know, socially and in crimes. And they're usually sorted out early on, you know, as teenagers in their early 20s. But the ones that are really in society, the kind of the near psychopaths, these borderlines that are pro-social, they can go through their whole life with really not getting caught, so to speak, even though people close to them will know. But a lot of times people close to them don't want to admit this. They won't admit it. And so because they want to say, I can change him, I can do that, I can change her.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to believe that they have the control over it. Just like our own society, our own government, our own religions, parents, they want to say, we can shape that behavior and I can change it. So they're always hopeful that it'll change. And of course it doesn't with those people. Now there are some tells in the average psychopath who's not too brain damaged, the way they use their hands when they talk, the way they use personal pronouns too much, I, me, all of that.
Use their hands?
They overuse their hands when they're speaking. And
you mean like the guys on Sports Center?
Exactly. It's just like those guys. There's some body language that they use that's inappropriate. So if you're in a conversation with them, and it may take 15, 20 minutes to see it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a conversation, they'll use these personal pronouns, but they'll also talk about anything that's emotional in reference to them. But it's not just selfish, because a lot of people are just, you know, selfish, and they're always self-referential in this, but they use it in unusually inappropriate times. And so if you listen to some of the, you know, the John Gacy's or some of the real psychopaths over the years, and listen to them and how they use personal pronouns and their hands and their body language too. But you really got to be looking for it. You know, when you meet people, people can fool you for the first 15 minutes. You know, when you meet a schizophrenic, you don't know they're schizophrenic. But mm-hmm. after about 15, 20 minutes, they get too close to you, you know, their sense of body space and the way their eyes dart around. Or people with even Alzheimer's, because they have that 15-minute wrap down that sounds fine. But then after in the 20th minute, they give you the same stories over and over again. So with psychopaths and other personality disorders, if you allow them to talk long enough, there will be some tells there. But you got to know what they are, and you've got to see them.
We're speaking with James Fallon and about psychopathy. He's an award-winning neuroscientist, University of California, Irvine. And his memoir, part memoir, I guess it's part
I'm
science.
I'm going to start watching you, Bon.
Is The Psychopath Inside, a Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain on today's Topical Currents. One last break, and we'll be right back.
It's 91.3 WLRN. We're funded by listeners like you and by City National Bank, dedicated to redefining banking by providing personal relationships, local decisions, and best-in-class service. City National Bank. More information at citynational.com.
This is John Labonia, General Manager of WLRN. Thanks to the more than 2,000 people who contributed during our year-end pledge drive. You helped us meet the goal for the on-air portion of our fundraising efforts. If you didn't have a chance to give, you can still make your tax-deductible for 2013 contribution online at WLRNradio.org. And the next time you hear something you love on WLRN, you'll know that you made it possible.
When school's not in session, children may engage in risky behaviors. The Children's Services Council of Broward County funds programs for children that maximize out-of-school time. Details at cscbroward.org. The Children's Services Council of Broward County. Our focus is our children.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Professor James Fallon. We're talking about his book, The Psychopath Inside. And do you have an email, Bonnie?
Yes. Would you say that the psychopathy test is an accurate gauge? If so, how can someone taking the test know if those individual markers are indicative of psychopathy rather than of modern physiological defenses? Being that the indicators on the test are things that can be seen commonly in individuals, how can one know if it's the normal response of an individual or a manipulator rather than those of a psychopath? That's from Sergio.
I hope you can answer
that. Do you understand the question?
Yes.
Okay.
Sergio asks a couple of really right on the point questions. One is, you can take the hair psychopathy checklist test online, but it was really designed to be through interviews and case reports, very detailed, by two experts. They don't have to be psychiatrists, but they have to be expert in the test, because people looking at these different questions about charm and lying, well, there's a normal range of that stuff we don't consider psychopathy. It's when you do it and you don't have to do it to save yourself, if you will, and it's the pathological lying, when you're just making stuff up because it's fun and you're manipulating people, not because you're a salesman, but you just really have a great joy in manipulating and conning people. And so you have to know how to score, because people will tend to score it too high, because the real pathological part, which is, you know, you have 0, 1, or 2 points. To get to 2 points, you really got to be bad at that stuff. You know what I mean? So the other thing, there's an online PPI test, and that PPI is pretty reliable. And in that,
what is that?
You know, the PPI you can take in this was the one that was also rated this year on all of our presidents and how they scored. And you know,
that's
that
the Minnesota
uses,
test. Or?
No, that's MPPI. That's a very good test of personality. But for psychopathy, this PPI tests for fearless dominance, which is kind of like the factor one in hair, and impulsive antisociality, which is kind of factor two. But when they look through the one major one, major trait for our U.S. presidents, fearless dominance, that people who scored very high, Teddy Roosevelt, JFK, FDR, Bill Clinton, George Bush not as much, and it goes all the way down, Jimmy Carter hardly at all, but it correlates with leadership. And it tells us that we expect a certain level of this stuff in our leaders. And so, you know, we ask for this. We think leadership has to do with this charm, and people have that light around them, the charisma, and they have a fearlessness, and they take risky chances. They lie. Like, you know, we know that FDR lied, but it saved the country, so it's okay lying. It's like, it's okay if you lie if it's good for me. And so that test, the PPI, is a good one that you can take online, and it'll give you a good idea of where you stand on these two major traits in psychopathy.
And what is that website?
The website is, well, if you just look up personality processes and individual differences.
Personality.
I don't know what...
Okay,
yeah,
well, we'll find it because we have,
yeah.
We'll have a link, of course, to your book on our WLRN.org page and our Facebook page. Do you have another website, by the way?
Well, to people who are interested in my geek work as a scientist, you just go to UC Irvine and type my name in. And you can also just Google me, just James Fallon, and, you know, a lot of my talks and other work that I'm involved in, you can find it just by using those two names.
Okay.
You got to put minus Jimmy on because we get that rascal Jimmy Fallon.
Yes, yes.
To pollute my hits.
When I was reading the book, you say that 3% of Americans have antisocial tendencies. That seems kind of low. Here at the station, it's probably about 30%.
Well, I've had the heads of the surgical organizations of, you know, surgeons who want me to give talks because they go, you know, half the guys you're talking about, I work with them here because they have to have these traits. They have to have that coldness to work well. And it goes along with certain jobs. And in like I said, with leadership, being a CEO, it doesn't make them psychopaths, but they have those traits and we expect it of them.
We have an emailer. Well, it's Robin, wants to know how you behave when you're drunk, but that presupposes that you get drunk, and we'll forget about that, but wants to know if alcohol, if psychopaths, when they drink, get mean, and they're not mean when they're sober, if that's a sign.
Well, it's a sign of alcoholism, certainly. I do drink, and I can, you know, I'm like a weekend warrior. The thing is, when I drink, I become more friendly and less violent. So I really go that way. There are people, there are psychopaths who, when they drink, get really violent. But those people, see, they tend to sort themselves out as teenagers because they get in so much trouble, you know, with the drug use and everything, and it releases a certain behavior. But not everybody's like that, and not every psychopath's like that. They can have a very positive or neutral response to alcohol and drugs. And in my case, I'm pretty good with it, really. You want to be around me when I'm drinking. You don't want to be around me when I'm sober. You know, it's like, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's kind of true.
So how many, we just have about another minute, but you say you're making more of an effort now. So these discoveries about yourself have really changed your life in many respects, haven't they?
Yeah, I thought I knew myself. You know, when you get in your 60s, you're supposed to know yourself. And I turns out I did not. And so I just made a decision. Now, I don't think it's necessarily because I'm a nice guy now. I think I have so much pride, intellectual pride, that I can say I can do this. I can change myself, or at least I can do this. So I try to tap into those traits that are psychopathic in a positive way to kind of drive me through this and to see if I can change myself enough so that the people that are especially close to me will really find me a better guy.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Professor James Fallon. He's a neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, and he's written The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you,
James. Bonnie, Joseph, this was a pleasure being on with you. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Peter Jay. Online producer is Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links to the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you will. Tomorrow's program is with University of Arizona professor Douglas Kenrick. He's the co-author of The Rational Animal, How Human Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And today's calendar, on this day in 1894, 119 years ago, the birth of conductor Arthur Fiedler in Boston. He first took the Boston Pops baton in 1930 and led it for 50 years. John Williams was his successor. And on this day in 1989, 24 years ago, the animated Simpsons series begins on Fox TV. It's the longest-running American primetime scripted television series with 27 Emmy Awards and a Peabody. In 1999, Time magazine called it the 20th century's best TV series. Conan O'Brien was once on the writing team. One more while we remember Coach Kevin Lockery. On this day in 1991, 22 years ago, your Miami Heat loses the most lopsided game in NBA history, 148-80 to the Cleveland Cavaliers. That's 68 points. Oddly, the Heat make the playoffs for the first time that year in their fourth season. So we leave with a gem from the Simpsons Springfield Police Chief Wiggum. No, you got the wrong number. This is 912. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Here and Now is next from NPR News.
It's South Florida's NPR News.